You are listening to Business Daily on the BBC World Service. I am Justin Rowlatt. Today we are covering the sale of the century, the decision to float Uber on the New York Stock Exchange. No surprise that the ride-hailing app is bullish.
I think that the investments we've made and the people we've built over the last many years, we think we're setting up to win in a very competitive marketplace. But I think that's going to continue to be true, and I think that's frankly a good thing.
But not everyone is enthusiastic.
It has generally been losing roughly $1 billion a quarter, and there is no real end in sight for that.
So should you jump aboard? Find out here on Business Daily.
Right, so get it up on my phone. Here we go. Open the app. We're going to Piccadilly. 3 minutes away. Not bad. Here we go. Andy, my driver, has turned up.
What's in a name? Well, when your name becomes the noun for the service you offer, you know you're doing well. Think Hoover and vacuum cleaner, Kleenex and tissues, Band-Aid and plasters, and yes, Uber and ride hailing. But how much is that worth? Well, Uber has just filed for its IPO on the New York Stock Exchange. It wants to raise $10 billion, valuing the company at $100 billion. But its smaller rival Lyft's IPO earlier this month hasn't gone as well as expected. So what kind of shape is Uber actually in?
So that was all very efficient. £6, $5, here we are. David. Hey, David, very good to meet you. I'm Justin.
I just saw your text.
Nice to meet you.
So we've got an Uber waiting for you, so come and join me in the Uber.
Okay.
So, David, you're the Professor of International Business Administration at Harvard.
Yes.
Yeah, good, good. Right, so, David, I mean, let's kick off. I mean, we're in an Uber. I think we all know, you know, why Uber is effective. But can it ever make money? Last year it lost, what, $1.8 billion?
No, it lost much more than that.
Did it?
You're including the gains that it made from selling some of its assets. If you said on an operating basis, it lost closer to $4 billion.
So a company losing $4 billion consistently lost money year after year,
yeah.
And yet it comes in with this, what, $100 billion plus IPO valuation. I mean, what is going on there?
Well, part of it is the spectacular growth of the top line. To generate $50 billion in gross revenue in 6 years is extraordinary by any definition. However, it has generally been losing roughly $1 billion a quarter, and there is no real end in sight for that. Some people think Uber can become profitable if it starts to eliminate the competition. Others, like myself, are more skeptical because the barriers to entry in this business are relatively low. A driver, like the car we're in, can be both an Uber driver and a Lyft driver or a Get driver. The typical driver only stays a few months. So at the end of a year, only about 20% of all drivers are still driving for Uber.
Right. So if you're a driver, clearly this isn't a very successful or persuasive model.
Well, in the US, you get paid an average of about $10 an hour after you include all your costs. It's basically a minimum wage job.
Taxi driving has never been a way to earn a fortune, has it?
It's very hard to do. The challenge is if they start to reduce driver incentives and start to raise prices for consumers, then more players may come into the market and that would drive down their margins again.
Well, that is a very pessimistic outlook for people who are considering putting money into this IPO, isn't it?
Well, I think that part of the enthusiasm for Uber is thinking very far out in the future. The big cost for Uber is the cost of the driver.
Mm.
And so in a world where you believe there's going to be autonomous cars, if Uber becomes the default for an autonomous car fleet, relatively small numbers of companies would be able to compete. And that potentially makes it a profitable business. But that is probably 7 to 10 years away.
So you're investing now for a potential return, perhaps a decade away. Doesn't sound like a good bet.
But here's the alternative argument. Amazon made no money for the first 10 years. But now look at Amazon today. So when people are betting on it, they're betting it's another Amazon-like story.
Well, they say, look, we could become a kind of portal to all sorts of different transport. They could rent bikes, scooters. You know, we're just passing one of the great parks of London, Hyde Park. They could suggest that you and I get out of the taxi and walk because it'd be quicker and better for us. So they see themselves as a kind of multi-network service. Is that persuasive?
Most of it is not. If you're thinking about things like scooters and bicycles, those are essentially zero-margin businesses.
Well, I mean, I must say this is not adding up to a persuasive case for investing money in Uber, is it?
It's a bet on a speculative future. It's a bet on a company that's going to be huge. They could be a net revenue business of roughly $20 to $25 billion in maybe 3 years. Now, that's big. The new CEO is much more of a traditional businessman who is thinking about how to get costs under control.
So a kind of practical businessman's going to grind down costs, right, you know, push up profit margin.
Get out of markets that don't work. I expect at some point they'll start reducing their spending on autonomous vehicles. That's $250 million a year investment. They can buy that technology rather than invent it.
When somebody else has done it, like
exactly.
Google, for example.
Exactly. I can imagine a world in which you go from $4 billion in operating losses to something closer to break even. And then it looks a little bit more like Amazon.
David, thank you very much indeed. And that was David Yoffe, Professor of International Business Administration at Harvard Business School. And our Uber will now drop us back at your hotel, I hope.
Thank you.
Excellent. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with me, Justin Rowlatt. Today's programme is all about Uber, and naturally enough, I am in an Uber driving through central London. Well, few people can have travelled further in an Uber than Alex Rosenblatt. She's an ethnographer and reckons she's covered 8,000 kilometres exploring the new cultures the company has created. The result was her book, Uberland, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work. It challenges one of the founding principles of Uber, that its drivers are not employees.
Uber uses algorithms for lots of reasons. When it enters new cities, it doesn't enter as a competitive taxi company, it enters as a technology company and sidesteps the rules and regulations that apply to their industry competitors. Uber says, we don't set the rates, we use algorithms to reflect the supply and demand dynamics of the marketplace. And it also manages drivers through algorithms, where many of the communications are automated, where discipline is automated. Because Uber classifies drivers as independent contractors, it can't tell them exactly how to behave. There's no employee handbook when you get started. Instead, drivers learn the rules of this workplace through thousands of in-app notifications and text messages telling them how they should behave to get higher ratings, for example. And then Uber will use the rating system to determine whether or not drivers risk being deactivated, a technology word that means suspended or fired. And so the algorithms perform a managerial function, but create almost a legal distance in the employment relationship between Uber and drivers.
So what is the legal status of most Uber drivers then?
Well, in the United States, they're classified as independent contractors, but that has been contested. But Uber has tried to make that argument that if you're managed by an app, you may not be entitled to worker protections, you may not be classified as an employee. And what I've seen is that drivers are actually beholden to quite a lot of rules. Drivers don't set the rates. They can't negotiate how much you're going to pay them for the job. Uber sets the rates. It tells them when they're going to be fired.
Well, you say fired. I think Uber would say, look, these are free-acting individual agents who choose to, whenever they've got spare time, come onto the app and then take or not take jobs. If they don't want to take the jobs and go home, they can do that. I mean, they're free agents in ways that normal employees never would be. I can't just say, I want to go home now and, you know, not expect some kind of comeback from the BBC.
They're certainly free to log in or log out at will, but once they're online, there are rules for how they have to accept jobs. So, for example, Uber limits the information they have before they receive a dispatch. They don't know where the passenger is going and therefore can't assess how profitable the trip might be or even if it's unprofitable. If they reject the dispatch, it hits their ride acceptance rate. One of the drivers I encountered received a notice advising them that there was surge pricing in effect. That's an algorithm that raises the rates that drivers will be paid if they go and relocate to a particular area at a particular time to receive jobs. So, you know, you're a driver and you follow the prompt and you get to the surge pricing area and the driver receives a dispatch from a non-surge area. So there's no premium they're going to earn. They cancel it and then they get a notice from Uber saying that they risk being deactivated if they continue to manipulate surge.
Say I'm an Uber driver and I get annoyed and I think, hold on, this isn't fair. How do you complain?
Well, I saw drivers complain in forums quite a lot because they'd been deceived by their algorithmic manager. But of course, what Uber is providing is incentives without any guarantee. There's also targeted ads almost. Uber targets them and says, hey, we'll pay you $40 per hour if you do all of your rides in downtown LA, do 2 rides an hour, get a rating of 4.7 or higher on all of those trips, and accept 90% of all the trips that come your way. So there's a constantly shifting series of gamified incentives to work in this environment.
And on the other hand, there's a massive kind of threat of deactivation, isn't there? To what extent does that mean that drivers don't complain, you know, about, I don't know, things like an unpleasant or abusive passenger?
Well, some drivers fold issues like sexual harassment into the cost of doing business. A driver named Mehmet, who I interviewed in New York, had a passenger flash him, and he felt very uncomfortable with it. But he didn't complain to Uber because he worried that if he did, the passenger would vindictively make a counter-complaint. And drivers largely perceive that Uber favors the passenger.
But is it possible that what's actually happening is that we had the so-called Great Recession after the financial crash? It was a very, very tough labor market. And the opportunity, if you like, for companies like Uber to kind of chisel benefit out of desperate workers was presented by that market. Now we see the labor market becoming tighter. In that scenario, it might be much more difficult for Uber to hire. The balance of power, if you like, might shift towards the workers.
Certainly, Uber's powerful rise was facilitated by the Great Recession because it was born at a moment of great economic uncertainty. People were still suffering the loss of their jobs and foreclosures were rampant. Uber said, we have the technology to create entrepreneurship for the masses. In the end, I would say that Uber certainly facilitated job creation that scales really well through technology, but it doesn't create the kinds of opportunities for entrepreneurship that it was promising.
That was anthropologist of technology, Alex Rosenblatt. So what does Uber have to say for itself? Well, for a start, it insists that it is much more than just a glorified taxi service. Andrew Salzberg is Uber's head of transport policy. He says what the company is really offering is a much more comprehensive proposition. He calls it mobility as a service.
Frankly, we're seeing that among younger people and millennials. There's a changing attitude about buying a car and frankly may never own one at all. When we start to offer things like bikes and other modes of transportation, the combination of individual modes like that is actually genuinely more efficient just by straight time than it would be to own your own car. It's faster in the morning commute here in San Francisco to take a bike to work, but late at night you may need a car to get to the airport.
But what is driving the change?
To me, the big thing is technology. You know, the iPhone, frankly. You know, it used to be kind of hard to rent a car. Now, if you open your phone, knowing where you're going, we can offer you 2 or 3 different ways to get there. Some of them are faster or cheaper, a shared car, a bike, a ride that gets you there by the fastest and cheapest mode for that specific trip at that specific time. It was just impossible 10 years ago.
And this is stuff that you're moving into because you've kind of invested in bike sharing services, electric scooters, you've bought into peer-to-peer car sharing. Well, you can't make much money on bikes, can you? I mean, it's arguable whether you can make any money at all.
Well, I think we're excited that we can. I think we're offering, obviously the price point of a bike is lower than the price point of a ride in an Uber. But I think we think there's such a big market overall for mobility right now. Services like Uber in places like the U.S. are probably less than 1% of overall travel. You know, the vast majority is people driving their own cars. And we think the more that we can provide an alternative, like we talked about, that is more convenient than driving your own car by combining a bunch of services, there's just an enormous market to grow into right now, whereas we're really, really quite small if we look at it today.
Now, this is a crucial moment for Uber, isn't it? You've announced that you're looking to float the business, but underlying Uber, there is a really serious problem, isn't there? You've got a profitability problem. You struggle to make money.
Yeah, I think that we've had a long history of investing in the business and have not yet turned a profit, as you point out. But I think that's partly because we're focused on this big picture. You and I were just talking about how right now a thing like Uber, even in our biggest market, the U.S., we're less than 1% of overall travel. So a lot of that investment you're seeing in things that we've talked about, like autonomous vehicles or like new modes of travel, like bikes and scooters and the hardware development that goes into that, all of that is upfront costs we're paying now because we have a big picture vision of how this could look in the future. We're all, frankly, quite early in the transition from the overall transportation system we have now to something that looks more like mobility as a service in the future.
Yeah, personal transport may well be a great opportunity. And as you say, you're a very small part of it at the moment. But the reason you're not profitable is because there's a kind of issue. I was going to say a problem, a flaw, but you know, let's not call it a flaw yet. You tell me what you think. There is a big issue at the heart of your business model, which is at the moment you're subsidising passengers, riders, in order to undercut local taxis and get market share. And at the same time, you're subsidising the drivers through retention fees and other bonuses to drive with Uber, because you need to have the drivers, otherwise you can't offer the service. Those two together mean you're losing money in most markets hand over fist. Let me just put a figure on that. $4.5 billion lost last year. I mean, that's a huge amount of money for a company to lose, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a large number. I think the challenge comes when you're making the comparison between operating in a market and the overall loss of the company. So there's lots of things that are being invested in. I mean, we've spent quite a bit of time talking about autonomous vehicles. That's obviously significant sums of money that are being spent now without a short-term prospect of payback. So, I mean, you're right. I think at the end of the day, people have to be convinced that there's a story here that says this growth is going to justify the kind of numbers we're talking about, and that's what we're building.
Okay, fair enough. But the taxi market has always been a tough business to make money in, hasn't it?
Yeah.
The entry costs are relatively low. It's easy for customers to switch to a rival, you know, particularly these days with you know, smartphones. Prices are very transparent, and there really aren't that great economies to scale. So it is tough business to make money in, isn't it? And that remains at the heart of what you do.
Yeah, look, I think it's a very competitive market in many, many places around the world. And I think that's good. I mean, if I'm a rider or a driver,
it's good,
frankly,
for me. It's
like
also good for you if you want to float your company. It's good for me as a customer.
Yeah. Well, I think that's our job to figure out. But I think if I'm a customer, and most people who are listening to you are either customers or drivers with us, having a competitor here in the U.S. or elsewhere, I think is great for drivers who have multiple services, making sure that they're competing to offer the best service for them and for riders. So, yeah, you're right. That's a tough market to be in. I think that the investments we've made and the people we built over the last many years, we think we're setting up to win in a very competitive marketplace. But I think that's going to continue to be true. And I think that's, frankly, a good thing. I think that's something to be celebrated. I think in the old days, if you look at the way urban transport was delivered before, there was a lot less competition. And I think there's been a lot of new things delivered as a result of the competitive marketplace that you're talking about, which I think are positive for a whole bunch of players, including riders and drivers. And you're right, it's a competitive market. That's a hard case to make, but that's the one we have to make.
That was Andrew Sulzberg of Uber, ending your journey with Business Daily today. And don't forget, there is a queue of other episodes of the program just waiting for you. Hail them via the podcast app of your choice.